Welcome to Headson's Living Histories podcast, capturing and sharing the life stories of people who have used or worked in NHS mental health services in Sussex, following the closure of the old asylums in the 1980s, up to and including the COVID-19 pandemic and its aftermath. By listening to people tell us, in their own words, about their experiences, we explore the complex interplay between mental health and a life well lived. Over the course of a year, Living Histories volunteers have recorded 35 in-depth oral history interviews across Sussex, opening up new ways to reflect on the past, present and future impact of mental health on people's lives. The full interviews will remain sealed for 80 years in the Mass Observation Archive at the Keep, housed in the University of Sussex. But in these podcasts, with the permission of the interviewees, we present some of their memories, experiences and reflections for the first time. You might find some of the stories you hear challenging, as participants talk openly about the difficulties of living with mental ill health. Please be aware that topics including mental health crisis, suicide, abuse and neglect are covered in these episodes. Living Histories celebrates the strength, courage and resilience of people living with mental health problems and those caring for them. Our huge thanks to everyone who told their story. This episode, Believed and Understood, explores the role that diagnosis and treatment plays in people's lives. We touch on how mental health conditions are diagnosed, how labels can help or hinder, and how the right diagnosis and treatment impact people's recovery as they are supported to both make sense of their life and the challenges they have faced and move forwards from their difficulties. It includes reflections from both clinicians and people who have received diagnosis as we consider how naming a condition can validate, stigmatise or direct care.
I remember seeing a programme, I was sitting there and a programme came on and they worded the word OCD. I said, that's what I've got. So I phoned up the channel and they said, yes, that's it. And that's when I started seeing, realising what I had. I must have been, 90, about it was about in the early 90s, so 41, 51, 61, 71. Crikey, I must have been late 40s, getting on your late 40s when I actually saw somebody. I don't think it's done me any favours knowing, to be honest, because I said to my friend last night. But I am glad for everyone else that it's out in the open now.
I've never really been diagnosed. I had acute clinical depression. To this day, I don't really know what caused it, apart from the fact I had a very responsible job and it just ground down gradually. It just ground down very gradually and I couldn't work anymore.
People often don't have the opportunity still to this day to sit down and talk about their diagnosis that they've been given. I still see people who come through and they go, what is my diagnosis? They've been in the system for 40 odd years. And either they have had the conversation, they haven't been able to hold it because they've got a mental health problem, or there hasn't been an opportunity. And I can imagine it's probably the latter. There hasn't been an opportunity to have those conversations. And so because we run a different kind of service here where it's a relational service, you're working with people for 3 years, we actually do have those conversations. But to hear someone say, no one ever asked me what I understood or what I knew. So I think there's a lack. Often it becomes very medical.
Never was I told in hospital that I had psychosis, ever. Which has always remained a bit of a question mark. I don't know if they do that as a type of protection, whether you are not capable of understanding it at that point. If someone said to me, this experience is you, but nothing was explained, so I would basically be hallucinating.
That was the first time I went to talk to a doctor. I'd probably said about 10 words and he was writing a prescription for antidepressants. And then it started to get worse and there was clearly something seriously wrong. It was almost as if someone had switched off in here, in my brain. I mean, I was doing a very responsible, high-level job and I just couldn't cope with it anymore. and saw a succession of psychiatrists, some of them good and some of them not so good, over quite a few years actually. And then one day I was in the garden, digging the garden, and injured my foot. I went and had it x-rayed, and fortunately the radiologist was very switched on and said, no, there's nothing broken. But how old did you say this bloke was? He's got the bones of a 90-year-old. They're full of osteoporosis. So I wrote off to the Osteoporosis Society and they sent me a little leaflet about osteoporosis in men, and it said one of the reasons is your hormones are all to pot. So I, that day or the next day, I happened to see the psychiatrist and I said, I wonder if that's the reason. Could I have my hormone checked? And he said, his eyes lit up and he said, yes, and get all these other hormones checked at the same time. Before I'd got the results, I had a phone call one evening from some doctor I'd never heard of, and he said, we've arranged your brain scan. I said, what brain scan? Oh, didn't they tell you? We think you've got a lump, a tumour. Oh, great. That's how I learned. And yes, there was my pituitary gland, which produces hormones. It's supposed to be about the size of a pea. And it was a bit like a pea with a cocktail sausage sticking out on one side. That was the tumour. And it crashed into the frontal lobes of my brain, which was causing brain damage, which was why I couldn't cope with my job anymore. All sorts of things began to become clear.
I experienced a lot of trauma as a child, and abuse. My dad had an alcohol problem, and also both my parents had mental health problems. I always felt very different to other children. I didn't speak in school. I was, well, they didn't even call it selective mutism back then. They called it, they said in all my reports that I was painfully shy and mute and inaudible. Now I sort of understand that in the context that I was autistic, but that was never picked up.
My mental health diagnosis is organic personality disorder, which basically means mental health issues due to a physical health problem, which is perfectly accurate. I've had other diagnoses as well. That one is correct. Oh, and now make sure you record this. Nobody told me my diagnosis. It was obviously given to me by the people of Sussex Partnership, but they didn't give me a diagnosis. I happened to see it on the screen when I was at the GP's. And I looked it up online. I thought, wow, they got it right at last. Because I'd had several other diagnoses before, including bipolar, which is a joke because I'd never had a high in my life. Pituitary problems are very difficult to diagnose. I think the average person is something like 13 years between the start of symptoms and getting a diagnosis. So, you know, they've probably got there eventually, but not necessarily.
Diagnosis, that's something, diagnosis, I've got to get that one in. Got to really think about the diagnosis we give people. So I work with people that primarily have a diagnosis of personality disorder. Nobody should have that diagnosis. It should be called trauma. It's very stigmatising. None of us would like our personality to be insulted, but that is the diagnosis they still carry, a lot of the people I work with. It's very old-fashioned. It came, you know, years ago, where mental health was divided into neurosis or psychosis, and, you know, it was labelled in a medical way as personality disorder. But they don't have a personality disorder. They have a difficulty with managing emotions that can be learned. They can do it. It's possible. The way it was set up, mental health, the medical model, has got a way to go, I think.
Now, in 2002, I went to New Zealand. So it was like 27 hours, and I couldn't sleep at all. And then when I got back, people were saying, well, you know, try and stay awake until normal time, because then that, so I still didn't sleep. And so I then got caught up in sleep deprivation. I went to see my GP. He put me on antidepressants, and I thought it was a bit odd. At this stage, I hadn't really saw myself as depressed. Maybe nervous and anxiety, perhaps, at times. But anyway, he was a psychiatrist, so I thought, okay, my family were sort of saying, well, look, You know, how do you expect to get better if you don't do what your GP's telling you to do? This was the beginning of my problems, really, because I shouldn't have been on these antidepressants. I started taking them, and of course, 4 or 5 weeks later, I started getting even less sleep because these were actually adding to my problem. When I saw my GP, he doubled my dose, which obviously had more of an effect. All this time I wasn't working, I couldn't work. Sleep deprivation's an awful thing, and I was getting sort of 3 hours sleep, and it went down to about 1 hour until I took it upon myself to cut one of them in half. And then so I took 1.5 rather than 2, and I started getting a bit more sleep. So I went back to the doctor and said what had happened, what I'd done. I felt a bit bad that I'd done it. We thought we'd better take off those. And then very, very gradually things then started to go back to normal.
For many years I was on an SSRI, I think Prozac. It was given to me because I was told it would help with my emotional intensity. Now, knowing what I know now, an emotional intensity is part of who we are. It can't be medicated, it can't be fixed. But it's fine, I'm not self-harming, I'm not taking overdoses. But at the time I was, because I just wanted it to stop. I couldn't deal with the chaos and the pain that I was experiencing. And now I know that's ADHD, because the things that I was sharing are actually not bipolar, it's ADHD. But at the time, you know, there's a guy in a suit here earning 6 figures. He knows what he's talking about. So I didn't question it. Didn't feel able to. And in that clinic letter, it said that there had been possible childhood abuse and an alleged sexual assault. That still happens. If I hear that or see it, then there's hell to pay or whoever's done it, because it's so invalidating. And again, that said, so that's not important. The trauma isn't relevant.
I, after a very long journey, ended up seeing a psychologist. He was very highly trained in complex trauma and dissociative presentations. It sort of felt like finally I'd landed in the right place, of someone who could actually understand what was going on, whereas before it felt like I'd received various diagnoses, but it was almost like, didn't feel like they fit, didn't feel like it was helping me. But yeah, that psychologist picked up that I appeared to be presenting dissociative identity disorder, and that was kind of a revelation.
Medication has changed quite a lot. There were people with horrific side effects when I first started, tardive dyskinesia of people's kind of arms waving about, which again obviously made them look really not very well, and it was absolutely the medication that we were giving them that did it. People that were bright orange from the photosensitivity from chlorpromazine in particular. There was something called pyraldehyde that would melt the syringes that you drew it up in, so you had to use glass syringes. I mean, I never saw that being used, but it was still around, I think, when I started in 1986. So yeah, lots of changes, and obviously different medications bring different side effects, and there has definitely been good and bad in all of that. But ultimately, it means that people have a bit more choice. And obviously the information is out there now. We never used to really give people that much information about the medication. It was the kind of, the doctor knows best and they will prescribe something and you'll take it. I think we're still a little careless sometimes. What's a normal diagnosis for us is absolutely not a normal diagnosis for the person who's getting it for the first time. So I think things like that we still need to pay more care and attention to.
People still talk about being really fearful of asking any questions for a psychiatrist. How can that be helpful? There's so much there that we could go into, you know, class, gender, sex, race, you know, all that, those kind of things all come into it. But it's an institution. The NHS is an institution, isn't it? Health services are an institution. And I think there's a lot we've still got to learn around it. You know, why should you be fearful of seeing a psychiatrist?
I never liked the term service user. It's a person. Everyone's unique, and yeah, okay, they may have an identity at times where they need mental health care, and treatment, but they're still a person at the end of the day, and you see the person first before you see the rest of the needs, and I think that's always really important. I'm not sure I like the term patient either, but anyway, that's how we identify people sometimes. When we used to have our team meetings, I'd never say my client or my patient. I'd always say the person that I'm working with. I can recall one OT saying to me, "You never say my client, do you?" And I said, "Well, they're not my clients. I don't own that person. I prefer to refer to them as the person that I'm working with, because if I'm not working with them, then it's not a partnership."
I think sometimes we use words that people don't necessarily understand. I had one guy, long history, in and out. When he was unwell, could, you know, history of violence and aggression. But actually, if you spoke to him in language that he understood, he got it. He'd go out and use substances and come back, and he'd test positive. And you'd say to him, "You know, why are you being such a plonker?" And he'd go, "Oh, yeah, I see what you mean." But if I'd said, "You know, why didn't you consider," and did it in a long sentence, he'd have looked at me as if I'd lost the plot. I mean, to be fair, some of the language in my training, you'd think, okay, you really wouldn't want to use, because it was not very pleasant. But what we can do is learn from it and not do it again, not repeat it. And I think that's the difference now. I think people are much more aware of the impact of what they're saying or not saying. We need to think about the words. They're being heard as we want them to be delivered. And sometimes that, I think, that gets lost in translation, because we're trying too hard to be politically correct, and actually the person's looking at us going, "I haven't got a clue what you're talking about."
I have to mention it because it's important. I was severely depressed twice in 3 years in my old job, and I remember on one occasion I was sitting in front of the GP and saying, "Please, please, please, if you're going to refer me to CRHD, I'm the consultant there. So at least have the courtesy to let me know what you're going to do. Because you might be referring me to my own service." But you learn an awful lot about yourself and how to handle yourself.
I went on then to work at the Personality Disorder Service. Working there, though, made me absolutely realise that I don't have a personality disorder. And I just remember having a cigarette break with the lead SPFT manager, and she said, "You're autistic." And I'm like, "Maybe." Well, I started to hear three other nurses asking me if I was neurodivergent. I spoke about my experience of diagnosis, etc. And through working here, and I've learnt so much from service users as well, and realised, yeah, I'm autistic. I just think I was completely misdiagnosed. Meeting my peer mentor at the Trust, who is amazing, she'd recently realised that she's neurodivergent, and with her support, I sort of went for diagnosis because, one, medication, and two, reasonable adjustments, and really just understanding why the hell all of this has happened, and that actually I have complex PTSD.
If our doctor speaks to us and takes on board our concerns and prescribes accordingly, and we felt fully heard, compliance is much higher. And I want to know, you know, what people's belief systems are, to take them into account. So it's actually a very magical experience. But that's one of the greatest resources that is there, I think, and that isn't talked about. If there's trust, that is a huge asset.
I think that's the difference now. I think there's much more collaboration in decision making than there was historically, and certainly when I started my training, you know, "I'm the doctor, you will take this medication." "Yeah, but last time I took it, it made me feel ill." "I don't matter, I'm the doctor." And there is less of that most of the time. At the end of the day, you want them to take any treatment, whether it's medication or whether it's talking therapies or whether it's learning new skills, whether it's looking at how they you know, look at diversion techniques if they're getting really anxious, how they can then, you know, it's about them taking ownership and taking it on board, right? You know, it's no good of saying, well, you must do this, and because you'll get, well, I don't want to, and you can dot off. It's like, oh, I really liked it when I did that, can we try that again? Yeah, absolutely, let's try that again. You know, you're wanting to work with them rather than coerce them or direct them, because at the end of the day, they've got to be able to manage their well-being. We've got to provide them with the tools.
Everyone has been great, to be honest with you. Everyone has been very helpful, very kind. But they all come up with the same thing. Try this tablet. But there's no magic cure. There's no wand to wave and get it, you know. And truthfully speaking, I don't want to be negative when I'm out there. I don't know anybody that's been cured. I only look if I can get 25% better, so I can go down and have a coffee and walk back. I'll be very grateful.
I think there is still a lack of understanding about medication and what it can and cannot do, and everyone hopes that it's going to work, but sometimes people still do get the symptoms, but they're reduced, and not every drug works for everybody, and sometimes it is a process of elimination.
The things that really was a lifesaver when I look back, when I think about it, was the experiences that we had picking magic mushrooms. It wasn't deeply embedded, but there were a few experiences that really helped to get through the depression and to see other possibilities. You know, in recent years, medical experiments with psilocybin and depression, there have been lots of studies where they've been proved to have lots of good results. You know, I was a kind of my own guinea pig, as it were. Just the perspective on the universe and connection with spirituality at a much deeper level was, hugely helpful and influential on my outlook on life, really. And the desire to try and make the best of things, to do something positive in the world.
One of biggest amount of people that you have is people with emotionally unstable personality disorder. They try to bring in more services for that. That wasn't high on the agenda in the past. It will be more of the classic bipolar, schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, or depression and anxiety. And also people that's neurodivergent. I've seen that going from having probably one referral to hundreds, and then there's the 6 years to wait for an assessment. For a lot of people, it's not that they necessarily want a diagnosis, whether it's EUPD or whether it's autism, but it's a better understanding of how and why things are difficult for them or they behave in a certain way. So, I mean, for some people it might be about just getting the diagnosis, but for a lot of people it's to say you're not unusual. The way you feel and the way you're acting, there's an answer to why.
I would say learn everything you can about your diagnosis. Though sometimes I think it's good to forget your diagnosis and just be a normal person. Look after yourself mentally, physically, go for walks, spend time outside.
Kindness. But we've got to clarify what kindness is, really, haven't we? So I think I wrote some words down. It's dignity, respect, and what were the others? To be believed and understood and safe. I mean, that's a tall order, isn't it? It's what we want in our whole lives.
This episode of Heads On's Living Histories podcast was produced as part of a collaboration between Heads On and Sussex Partnership NHS Foundation Trust. Living Histories was funded by the National Lottery Heritage Fund, NHS Charities Together and Heads On. We're deeply grateful to all the participants who shared their stories and to the many staff, volunteers and project partners who have made Living Histories possible. If you found this episode interesting and would like to hear more, please visit www.headsoncharity.org/histories, where you can learn more about Living Histories and listen to other episodes. If you've been affected by anything you've heard in this episode, support is available. Please visit www.sussexpartnership.nhs.uk/your-mental-health/getting-help. Audio production by Charlotte Petz and Michael Umney. Music by Chad Crouch. Narration by Living Histories volunteer Ian Barnett. Oral history clips taken from full interviews with project participants from across Sussex for Heads On's Living Histories. For more information about Heads On's other projects, please visit www.headsoncharity.org.